Boyd. Up next on Think, how a crowd turns violent. As a nation, we're still processing the scene that unfolded in Washington on Wednesday when the very symbol of U.S. democracy was overrun by a mob claiming to actually be defenders of democracy. We'll spend this hour with Rob Henderson, who studies human behavior at the University of Cambridge, talking about why people are more easily whipped into a frenzy when surrounded by like-minded thinkers, and about how crowds provide cover for individuals to violate laws and social norms that they would never break by themselves. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
This week has me thinking about crowds. Many of us were transfixed by images of pro-Trump extremists taking over the Capitol building on Wednesday. But before they overtook police guarding the entrance to House and Senate chambers, the mob that interrupted certification of the Electoral College votes for president were part of a group assembled at a park just south of the White House to the delight of President Trump. Stop the steal, they were saying. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The thing that puzzles me is there are people all over the country who believe the election was somehow stolen from President Trump, despite a lack of credible evidence. But most of those folks did not travel to Washington to vandalize federal property and terrify legislators. Presumably, most of the people who did do those things Wednesday had never done anything similar and wouldn't have stormed the Capitol if they were alone. Is there something about being in a crowd that changes how we think and what we're willing to do? Rob Henderson joins us to talk about this. He's a writer and military veteran currently pursuing a PhD in psychology at the University of Cambridge, and he's written about crowd behavior for Psychology Today. Rob, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me again.
So I guess you were observing all the bizarre events of this week surrounded by British people. What sort of reaction did your colleagues and friends have to images from the Capitol?
Well, you know, just like in the U.S., we're all sort of cooped up inside, so I haven't had a lot of sort of group conversations with, you know, the Brits here, but I've talked to some people on the phone and on group chats, and yeah, people do seem, you know, disturbed. You know, one of my British friends, you know, texted me, America is effed, you know, he spelled out the word, but, you know, he was very concerned with what's going on. I think that sentiment is pretty prevalent over on this side of the pond.
So, look, there are many kinds of crowds, and most of them don't get out of hand in any way. But I'm curious about how being part of a crowd can affect our identity, at least temporarily. What do you know about that?
Well, there's some interesting research, you know, some classic social psychology on this idea called de-individuation. And, you know, basically the idea is that people sort of experience a loss of individuality, a loss of personal responsibility when we become a part of a group. You know, it can take a positive and a sort of negative direction. So, you know, if we're in a crowd and people start to, say, donate large amounts of money to a good cause, that might cause us individually to sort of participate in that act too. But it can also sort of lead to, you know, large-scale mob violence or, you know, all kinds of destructive behaviors. We sort of get swept away in that and lose our sense of our own identity.
At Wednesday's rally, the leader of the assembled group was President Trump, but he, of course, did not go with them to the Capitol. So we can assume some other person sort of directed the actions of that crowd, officially or unofficially. How do certain people emerge as leaders from among a group of peers in a crowd? Like, why does anybody follow any other person in a crowd?
Yeah. I mean, that's a really interesting question. You know, oftentimes, you know, someone who might have a certain kind of personality or disposition, you know, may just sort of vie for leadership within a group. And then other people will sort of coalesce and either sort of accept that person's leadership or not. It can be a sort of spontaneous, organic situation where, of course, there's no like official vote in these kinds of like, you know, situations, but people can sort of attempt to exert leadership or dominance and then sort of test to see how people react. And if people sort of go along with it, then they sort of become the de facto leader. Sometimes what can happen is, a person advised for leadership and other people look at everyone else to see what they're doing. And, you know, people can sort of go along with a leader who individually none of them really like or would have chosen themselves, but they believe that the others have chosen this person, so they sort of go along with it.
This is so interesting. So we can look around and it looks like everybody is behind the leader. Other people may be secretly harboring the same doubts we have, but if they're not showing that, we're not going to show it either.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of interesting work from the economist Tim Curran, his idea of preference falsification and pluralistic ignorance. And the idea is, you know, basically that people believe that others think something that they really don't. And those people think that you think something that you don't. And so we can all sort of collectively start to sort of go along with something that none of us really endorse or support simply because we believe that a consensus has taken place, but it's illusory.
So there's been research for some time now to show that being part of a group of somewhat like-minded people can cause nearly everybody in that group to align their views with like the most extreme versions of the shared beliefs. What's going on there?
Yeah, it sort of depends on the specific situations, but you know, a couple of studies I'm aware of. So there was one of the classic studies on group polarization. I think this was in the 1960s in France. But what they basically did was took a group of people who all sort of held a tentatively positive disposition toward a political leader. They sort of liked this person, and they all were gathered in a room and were sort of asked to talk about this person for a while. And at the end of the conversation, you know, the researchers once again sort of measured their attitudes towards the political leader, and all of them had become much stronger in their support for this leader. Essentially, what seems to happen is that when our own tentative beliefs are reflected back at us, those beliefs seem to strengthen, they seem to magnify, and we become sort of more confident in our initially tepid beliefs. There's also been some research, so Kat Sunstein, in his book, I think it was either last year or the year before, Conformity, great book, he cites some research on juries, and what he found is that when juries are deliberating fines for offenders, you know, how much should this person be fined? The outcome of those processes, the fine is almost always higher than what the median juror had initially suggested. Hmm. And so what seems to happen is that, you know, the jurors sort of, suggest a number for how much the fine should be. They deliberate, and over time, it seems to creep upward, such that the final result is actually higher than what you might think based on the average. And this is because people sort of ramp up and want to be sort of the most punitive. They want to sort of demonstrate that, you know, no, I want to be the one to show that I condemn this bad behavior that this person committed. No, I do. And I can show this by sort of increasing this number. And it's the same thing with the political leader. Initially, once you learn that everyone supports this person, now you want to be the one to show the most support so that you can gain the most favor among that group.
So you've written about something called the Overton window and how it relates to political polarization in recent years. Can you explain that term for us?
So the Overton window is coined by this guy, Joseph P. Overton. And the general idea is that certain ideas and opinions have to fall within a certain window or a certain range of acceptability to be either politically viable or sort of publicly palatable. There are certain ideas that we can express publicly. There are some sort of more fringe ideas that that are still sort of within that window, but people might sort of shy away from. And then there's the sort of extreme and radical ideas that very few people would publicly endorse. And so, you know, we hear this phrase a lot in political conversations, whether an idea falls within that Overton window.
Is there some way to, you know, prevent ourselves from the effects of groupthink, or separate ourselves from the effects of groupthink, short of cutting off contact with all the people we feel like we agree with?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, you know, if you sort of let people do what they want and you know, sort of freely associate with who they like, then they tend to gravitate towards people who think like themselves. It feels good for people to sort of form a consensus and to sort of be well-liked. There's some interesting research on this question about, you know, what causes us to sort of feel good, to feel satisfied. And one interesting finding is that sociometric status, which is defined as respect and admiration from our peers, contributes more to our happiness and our sense of well-being. That contributes more to that than our socioeconomic status. So sort of, you know, being liked and being sort of esteemed by people around us, that makes us happier than even how much money we have. So, yeah, and of course, if you are interacting with people who disagree with you, the chances of of you liking them or them liking you can drop. So, you know, I think it takes a conscious effort, you know, to be around people who you disagree with and to understand that, you know, you may not have all the answers. They certainly don't have all the answers, and to sort of go out of our way to overcome that sort of, you know, internal barrier of like, I just want to be around people who I agree with.
And in the modern world, it's not just the people we know, right? Most of us are not friends with Rachel Maddow or Tucker Carlson, but they can sort of start to feel like part of our circle if we're watching their shows every day and sort of absorbing what they have to say. How does the digital era change our exposure to strong ideas and the sense that there is kind of one way to look at the world?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, I remember seeing, it's kind of sad, I saw this story about these YouTubers. And, you know, their whole sort of the channel was basically them sitting in front of the computer while they were eating a meal and talking to the camera as though the viewer, the audience, is sort of eating with them. And it sort of simulates this sort of social and sort of like, you know, sort of like you're having a meal with someone else and feeling that sense of social connection. And I think something similar, yeah, might be going on with television, with, I think, like podcasts are, you know, people walking around with their earbuds and constantly hearing this. This can sort of sometimes replace social connection. There's some like kind of, yeah, some research showing that people seem not to trust the media as much as they used to. I remember seeing this Gallup poll, I think it was last year. They measured media trust in the 1970s, and it was something like, you know, either 60 or 70% of Americans said they trusted the media, so we have a vast majority. But by 2019, it was only about 40%. But when people are responding to these polls, you know, oftentimes I think they're when you know they're responding to questions about the media, they're thinking of the other media, the bad media. You know, either the, like you said, either the Rachel Maddow if they happen to be conservative, or Tucker Carlson if they happen to be liberal. You know, it's the other side's media that's unreliable, but my side is good. And you know, especially if you happen to listen to them a lot and sort of absorb those ideas, like a lot of politically engaged people are doing.
My guest is writer Rob Henderson. He's pursuing a PhD in psychology at the University of Cambridge. He's written for Psychology Today about crowd behavior. We're talking about the science of crowd behavior in light of what happened this week in the nation's capital. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today about the science of crowd behavior with writer Rob Henderson, who's pursuing a PhD in psychology at the University of Cambridge and has written about crowd behavior for Psychology Today. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Rob, how does the belief that, like, everybody on the other side of whatever we believe is not just different from us, but dangerous from us, how does that affect our willingness to take extreme action to counter or punish people that we think of as being separate from ourselves?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a tendency for people. The social psychologist Roy Baumeister has written a book about this called Evil. And he describes this idea as the myth of pure evil, which is basically that, you know, the other side, you know, in the political context, you know, they're not just sort of mistaken, or they're not they're just misguided, but they're actually evil. They have you know, sort of evil intent, and they want to do bad things. But, you know, one thing Baumeister points out, and other researchers too, is, you know, that most people are, you know, are not the bad guy in their own movie. Most people believe themselves to be doing the right thing. I mean, even if you look at sort of the most like vicious people, you know, for example, like Osama bin Laden believed that he was doing the right thing, you know, as terrible as the acts were, in their own minds, they believe that that was the right thing to do. And so I think one, you know, it's an easy thing to do is to just say, just condemn them fully, but to try to understand them and to see how other people think, how they came to their beliefs, and also to reflect on our own beliefs as well. I mean, oftentimes we'll find, you know, at least for me in my case, when I think about how I arrive at certain beliefs, I've discovered that, you know, this is just something that I picked up along the way. I've just sort of absorbed it, but I didn't arrive at it through some sort of like rational and deliberative process. And that's how I think most of our sort of social and political beliefs are. We don't arrive at it in that way. We just sort of pick it up and absorb it from the people around us. So I think it's useful to remember that we're all human, and most people believe that they're doing the right thing, even if, you know, that the actions themselves are, you know, are something that we don't support.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have William calling from Maynard, Texas. Hey, William.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. So, yeah, it's very interesting what your guest was talking about with regards to, you know, how people, without even thinking about it, link their own, or their sense of personal survival is attached to what their group is doing. At the unique, growing up as the son of missionaries during the Mobutu Sese Seko era in Zaire, or as it's now called, Congo. And one of the more traumatic and shocking experiences that I had was seeing a mob chase a person down in the street and stone this guy to death. And in that group were people who I was used to seeing in church on Sunday. And, you know, so I had a conversation with them afterwards, and they weren't really able to provide a rational explanation for why they did something which was so far beyond the pale. There was no possible way for them to justify what they had done. There simply was no link between this person's behavior. They were just seized up in that moment and participated with the violence that happened without ever, to their own recollection, ever having made a conscious decision to do so.
Well, thank you for sharing that story, William. I'm so sorry that you had that experience, and what a terrifying thing. Rob, do we sort of lose our ability to reason when we're part of a mob that's getting out of control?
Yeah. I mean, I think perhaps one thing that occurred, you know, in the caller's story there was that sense of the individuation of sort of losing our sense of identity and personal responsibility. And this is something that's sort of, you know, it's been observed before. There was, you know, this 20th century anthropologist, Claude Levi Strauss, who wrote that, you know, for most of human history, humankind ceased at the border of the tribe or the village. You know, in hunter-foraging societies, you know, people lived in communities or bands of, you know, 100 to 300 people, and that those were you know, the humans to them. Those were the people, and anyone else outside of that they were viewed as threats for resources, threats towards your own group to take what you have. And so this kind of group thinking comes very naturally to us. One thing that I was thinking about is, because of the ongoing pandemic, sports have, for a while they were completely canceled. Some of it's coming back, but I think, one perhaps healthy outlet for this kind of tribalism is sports, because, one person can like the Yankees, the other person can like the Red Sox, and they can sort of tease each other, but the stakes aren't such that, they're willing to go to blows over it. But it is, I think, a sort of outlet for a person to sort of express pride in a group without it becoming toxic or spiraling out of control. But since, for a while the sports were put on pause, I think a lot of that tribal energy might have been going more towards politics.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Sorry, I just swallowed some tea the wrong way when Rob was talking. I'm fine. Let's go next on the phone to Nora in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Nora.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Well, I want to be part of you guys' club because you sound really smart. So I'm going to try to sound really smart, my question. But which is, what's the tipping point? What's the deal with, say, for example, I'm a woman, but when I'm around a bunch of dudes, I want to prove that I'm kind of dudely, or I'm Jewish, but maybe sometimes when I'm around people who aren't Jewish, that I want to show them that I'm like them. So what's that all about?
That's an interesting question. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that is an interesting question. And I think all of us do this to some degree. I mean, there's this idea in social psychology called self-monitoring, and people who tend to score highly on self-monitoring, they tend to like mirror the actions of others. They tend to sort of track how the other person is perceiving them, the impressions they're giving off. Those people tend to do like pretty well in terms of their careers, in terms of their social relationships. Perhaps one thing going on there is you feel this urge to sort of fit in with that group. You want to sort of win them over. You want to gain their favor. And, I think that's totally natural. Very few people enjoy being disliked. And so I think when we're in a environment where people are a certain way, we try to sort of meet them where we can and to sort of build those social bonds with them.
Besides race in America, it seems like politics has become one of the primary ways we define ourselves. Why now? Like, people have always voted for different parties and preferred different candidates. Why have we been led to think that somebody who sides with the other party is someone we have nothing in common with, when we might not have felt that way 30, 40 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, the research on this is fascinating. I mean, if you look at, for example, in the early 1960s, the vast majority of Americans said they would not be okay if their son or daughter married someone of a different race. Whereas today, the vast majority of Americans report that they're perfectly fine with it. But yeah, again, in the 1960s, if you asked Americans about whether their son or daughter married someone of the opposite political party, they were okay with it, whereas today they're not. Most Americans today would not like one of their kids to marry someone who held different political views. So, I'm not sure what's happening with this. I think before we were discussing about the effects of the media and how we tend to be siloed into our groups and sort of feed those ideas back off of each other, that sort of group polarization. Something else that might be happening here is the sort of alarming trends in the lack of confidence that people tend to have in one another. So I just saw this study in Pew that showed that as recently as 2007, about 60% of Americans were confident in their fellow citizens to make good political decisions, to sort of vote for the right policies and the right leaders and so on. Most Americans had faith in their fellow citizens. But today, it's reversed, such that 60% say they have little or no confidence. So we're sort of losing our trust in one another. And I think that this sort of lack of social bonds, this sort of lack of trust in one another can also sort of amplify political anger and this belief that, you know, we're sort of in a system with good guys and bad guys, and we need to sort of, you know, have our group overcome the bad guys.
I want to talk about how any group starts to behave in violent or destructive ways. The group that left Ellipse Park in D.C. and marched toward the Capitol building could have just remained peacefully outside the Capitol building. I don't know what sort of pre-planning was involved, but as it happened, they forced their way in. They terrified the people who were working in the building. Things, again, they would not have done if they were alone. What tips a crowd from just being angry to being angry and destructive?
Yeah. I think in those kinds of situations, I think the economist Thomas Schelling has written about this, about sort of these domino effects in these kinds of like demonstrations or sort of protests, where, you know, every individual person wouldn't want to sort of like, you know, get arrested or to take, you know, take that risk of breaking the law. Everyone is sort of waiting for someone else to do it first, if they were to do it themselves. And so in those kinds of like large crowds, those situations, I mean, if you just a large enough group of people, the likelihood that one of them is going to take that chance is, you know, it grows the more people you have. And once everyone sort of sees that, then the next person becomes more likely to do it. And then once you see two people, then you become more likely and so on. And so at the beginning, you know, as long as tensions are not so high and things are calm and orderly, then it won't necessarily spiral out of control. But as soon as one or two people sort of breach that boundary, then others will sort of follow suit and engage in that kind of mob behavior.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there any logic to, you know, looting and vandalism? I mean, I'm always curious about when crowds are demonstrating to make a particular point and they end up, you know, committing acts of vandalism or violence against targets that may have nothing to do with the things they're upsetting about. They're upset about. Is there some rational mechanism behind those choices, or are people just out of control and looking for some way to vent their rage?
Yeah. Well, I think that there are probably multiple things going on here. I mean, a lot of these sort of social movements, they probably are led by true believers, people who genuinely believe in the cause, and they believe that, you know, they're sending a message by engaging in destruction of property or violence or what have you. But those kinds of movements, you know, and those kinds of like large-scale group activities tend to draw other kinds of people as well. They tend to draw people who don't even necessarily care what the cause is, or what the demonstration is about. They just want to get in there and mix it up and get into fights. You know, over the demonstrations last summer, I was talking to a friend of mine. You know, he sort of grew up the same way I did, sort of, you know, working class, poor, blue collar community, and not a lot of adult supervision. And, you know, in high school, we would get into fights. We would do a lot of, you know, sort of dumb things. And both of us sort of agreed that, you know, if something like that happened nearby to us when we were 17 or 18 years old, we would have gladly jumped in. You know, the idea of taking a baseball bat and breaking some cars would have been fun to us. Like, we wouldn't have known what it was about. We're just like, oh, the cops aren't doing anything, so let's go have some fun. That's sort of like, that appeals to more, you know, at least in my, you know, more young males than maybe we want to believe. So I think there's both going on. If you happen to create that kind of social environment, you do run the risk of attracting, you know, certain kinds of young people who just want to break things and to engage in some violence and destruction.
I'm curious, too, about how the presence of another group in close proximity can affect the identities of members of each group. So, in other words, if one group on the scene is demonstrators and the other group is police, do the police feel extra policey and the demonstrators feel extra angry? Do they define themselves in opposition to one another?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure off the top of my head I know any research or anything that goes to that question. But, you know, my sense would be that because people do tend to define themselves, you know, by their group membership, and tend, you know, and part of that group membership is sort of setting yourself in contrast to whoever the opposing group is, then yeah, that would make sense to me, that if the police are present, and of course, like, there are all these markers of group membership as well. So the police are wearing certain kinds of uniforms, they're all in a group, they may all know each other, and same with the demonstrators as well, that, you know, oftentimes they wear certain kinds of clothing or certain kinds of markers or claim to be a part of a certain kind of group or movement. And yeah, in that case, both of those, that kind of situation may intensify whatever kind of hostility exists. You know, in kind of the same way, I guess, with sporting teams. I mean, you know, sporting teams wear certain kinds of jerseys, certain colors, certain names, and so on. And when you identify with that, you sort of set yourself apart from the others.
We have a tweet here from Stephen who asks if you can comment on the possibility of some kind of collective psychosis due to the consumption of conspiracy theories from websites like QAnon.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of inconsistent findings on that. A lot of, you know, some research does suggest that people are responding to social media and conspiracy theories and so on. But there's other research suggesting that, you know, social media actually doesn't have much effect on people's beliefs. Exposure to media in general, research indicates that people tend to overestimate the effects of media on other people, on the audience.
Hmm. My guest is Rob Henderson. He's pursuing a PhD in psychology at the University of Cambridge, and he's written about group behavior for Psychology Today. We're talking today about the science of crowd behavior. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Rob Henderson, who's pursuing a PhD in psychology at the University of Cambridge and has written for Psychology Today about crowd behavior. We're talking about the science of crowd behavior and groupthink. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where Francis is on the line in Fort Pierce, Florida. Hi, Francis.
Hi. Yes, thank you. I'm alarmed to hear around. Fine with what happened. And I hear the legislators talk about Trump who incited it. So my question to Mr. Henderson is there any evidence one way or the other if you not overly harsh on the leader as far as any further uprisings, or if it is better to take it to the full extent of the law against the leader in quelling further in.
Thanks for calling. I don't know if you know about evidence to that effect, Rob.
Yeah, that is really interesting because I could imagine it going both ways where, you know, on the one hand, if you, you know, if you sort of punish to the full extent of the law, then this can send a message to, you know, future would-be protesters. But if you, you know, if you, also if you do that, you know, that you run the risk of potentially radicalizing more people and angering people, and might actually increase the likelihood of future sort of violent protests. So I actually don't know any research on that, but that's a very interesting question.
So just so I'm clear, I mean, people can do things. There's evidence that people are willing to do things as part of a big riled up crowd that they wouldn't do on their own. But it's not as if we become automatons and that we lose all free will, right? It is possible, right, to stop yourself when you're in the middle of a crowd that is up to no good?
Yeah. I mean, there is, I mean, of course, we don't totally lose ourselves. The de-individuation process, I think it of course, there are individual differences where some of us are more likely to do it than others, but I think most of us do have the ability to sort of stop and reflect on what we're doing. It's hard to do that. I think it's sort of natural to go with the crowd, to sort of follow what others are doing and sort of socially conform, but it takes extra effort. I think, yeah, just being aware of it is the first step. When we see others doing something that we disagree with, to sort of notice. And, you know, even if you don't sort of voice your concern or your disagreement, which could actually be violent in some cases, if people are in that sort of mob mindset and you try to, you know, sort of voice concern of it, you run the risk of them turning on you. So, you know, just to quietly exit and not partake in it. Take some effort, but I think it's possible.
I've looked over and over at that photo of the guy, a lot of us have seen it, hanging by one arm off the balcony above the Senate floor. He's been identified as a man from Idaho named Josiah Colt. He's since come out with an apology saying, like, in the moment, I thought I was doing the right thing. It's interesting to me that, you know, if someone like Josiah Colt realizes now he wasn't doing the right thing, you have to wonder about the people surrounding him and the ways that they were influencing his thinking at the time, or what his emotional state was that caused him to do something that, you know, 24 hours later, he realizes was a bad move.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, but that aligns with a lot of the research that people who commit, you know, violent acts or crimes, in the moment, they do tend to think that was the right thing to do. I remember seeing this really interesting research study of prison inmates, and the psychologists, you know, basically asked them how they evaluated themselves on all kinds of different qualities and traits. And prison inmates, including violent inmates, tended to rate themselves as above average on moral character. And when the psychologist asked them to sort of evaluate themselves on law abidingness, you know, how did they compare to others in terms of obeying the law? They rated themselves as average. So even, you know, even violent inmates believe that they're sort of, you know, about the same as anyone else when it comes to breaking the law. So there is this kind of this my side bias, this belief that what we're doing is right, and we sort of come up with these self-serving justifications to explain why we did what we did and portray it in the best positive kind of light.
All right, back to the phones now, this time to Allentown, Pennsylvania. Aaron is on the line there. Hi, Aaron.
Hello. I had a question about individuals and whether there's a measurable or some kind of metric that gives more capacity to others to be individuals versus, like, some people might be more willing to just go with the crowd and some might not.
Thanks for calling.
I don't know of any, you know, any kind of research or study on sort of increasing levels of individualism. I mean, if you look across different cultures, different countries, you know, on average, sort of more industrialized countries tend to be more individualistic. You know, the U.S. is actually one of the most individualistic countries in the world in terms of, you know, sort of people wanting to make their own decisions and not sort of following what other people are doing or what's expected and so on. But I don't know if we would want to entirely, you know, get rid of that tendency towards social conformity. Sometimes it can be used toward the good. I cited that example earlier of, you know, when we see others behaving in a way that's sort of, you know, positive, charitably, then we're more prone to do so as well. So there can be positive effects of the crowd. One example of this, there's this famous study, the Milgram study, which many people have you know, read about or maybe seen the movie. But the study was basically the psychologist, you know, he had people believe that when they were flipping switches on a machine, they were electrocuting someone else in another room. They weren't actually being electrocuted, but they were led to believe this was the case. And in that kind of setup, you know, most people, I think more than 60% of people listened to the researcher and continued flipping switches to hurt this other person, you know, sort of because of the obedience to authority tendency that we have. You know, you see someone in a white lab coat, very official looking, okay, just do what they say. But in a variation of this, the researchers had three people enter this room and told them to collectively decide whether they wanted to flip these switches. But two of these people were actually working for the researchers, so they were sort of undercover participants. And the third person was just a naive participant. And they had it set up such that, you know, the researcher said, please flip the switch. And the two people working for the researcher refused. They said, no, I'm not going to do that. And more often than not, the naive participant went along with them and refused to flip the switch as well. So this was a case where the sort of collective willingness to conform to the majority to sort of refute the sort of, in this case, the sort of evil authority figure, it was actually something positive, this tendency to conform.
Rob, I'm really looking for you to tell me something that makes me confident that I would never behave in ways that I'm ashamed of if I were part of a crowd that got out of control. It sounds like you're not able to give me that. And I guess we all have to find a way to make peace with the fact that this is not something that only other kinds of people do, that given the wrong circumstances that we should probably avoid, we could make choices that we're ashamed of that are destructive.
Yeah, I think that's something that very few people reflect on. You know, when you read about history, we often want to believe that we would have been one of the few people to do the right, you know, to sort of stand on the right side of history, so to speak, and do the right thing. I saw this, I think it was a Twitter thread by this Princeton professor, Robert George, and he said that, you know, whenever he teaches, you know, his class on history about American slavery, he asks his students, you know, would you have been, you know, on the side of slavery, or would you have been an abolitionist? And, you know, he says, you know, well, guess what? The vast majority of my students believe they would have been abolitionists. But the thing is, if you were a person around 200 years ago, odds are you would have been, you would have sort of absorbed the sort of social mores of that time, the sort of moral codes of that era. And, you know, we still do that to this day. We sort of tend to do things that the people around us are doing. We are more prone to, you know, obeying authority or going along with the crowd than we think. And to sort of be aware of that aspect of our human nature, I think it's difficult, but I think that it might be necessary in order to not act on it. Like, the knowledge that you can do those things might prevent you from actually doing it.
Okay, if that's all you can give me, I'll take it.
Okay, there you go.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So some enormous crowds of people are notably peaceful, right? Things do occasionally go wrong at the Hajj in Mecca, but you have 3 million people sharing the same space most years, and usually everything goes pretty smoothly. Is there any identifiable difference between crowds that remain peaceful and those that get out of control?
Yeah, I don't know of any research on this question about, you know, what is the distinguishing feature of peaceful versus you know, non-peaceful or violent protests. There has been some work on the effectiveness of political protests, depending on whether they're violent or peaceful. And all of the research that I've seen definitely points toward peaceful protests being far more likely to actually translate into policy, into positive changes, into the protesters actually getting what they want. Violent protests very rarely succeed in their aims. So this is, you know, this may not be an actual distinguishing feature of the crowds themselves, but in terms of the outcomes of their actions, it does seem that peaceful protests are more effective.
So can crowds lead us to better behavior than we might have exhibited otherwise? You said at the top of the hour sometimes, you know, if there's a fundraiser and everybody takes out their checkbook, you might have wanted to toss $5 in the basket, but suddenly you feel pressured to put in $100 or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, there are these cases of people wanting to sort of impress others, and you know, sort of in that case, the crowd can work towards the good. You know, there's a kind of an amusing study, sort of related to this, where researchers found that men, if they were walking with, I think it was a date, they were more likely to give to a charity organization than when they were walking alone. And I think there were variations of this as well, with you know, people more likely to donate if, you know, sort of people they wanted to impress were looking on. There's even research on children on this question, and even kids are more likely to be generous if they're sort of being watched by other kids or by teachers or you know, other people.
What's the evolutionary upside of our tendency to very quickly forge a shared identity with a group that we're in, for better or for worse?
Well, I mean, so a lot of our psychology is sort of rooted in an era that, you know, this bygone era, 100,000 plus years ago, small bands of 100 to 300 people. And in those communities, you have to sort of learn to get along with the crowd and to build those bonds and sort of navigate those social dynamics. So, you know, we've sort of evolved to sort of build consensus and to get along with one another and to not cause social friction, and to sort of value our teammates while harboring suspicions of potential, you know, threatening outsiders. And, you know, one reason for this simply is because a human could not live alone in the Pleistocene, or, you know, just like in the forest somewhere alone, or in the savanna. If you drop one person there by themselves, they would very quickly die. But, you know, a couple hundred people together can sort of work out a system to survive. So we are sort of inherently a cooperative species. So there is an upside to this. You know, we sort of have become the, you know, the dominant species on the planet because of our hypersocial tendencies to get along with one another, to trade, to learn, to exchange, to care for one another.
Briefly, is there anything we can do before we're about to enter into a crowd so that we bond with the people around us in common cause, but stay true to our own values?
Yeah. I mean, I think just to sort of let people sort of express themselves and to learn about them, and they can learn about you, and to know that, you know, you probably have something in common with everyone, and to find those overlapping commonalities. While still, yeah, like you said, like still maintaining that sense of yourself is important. And I think something that all of us can work more on.
Rob Henderson is a writer and military veteran currently pursuing a PhD in psychology at the University of Cambridge. Rob, thanks so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts. You just search for KERA Think, or stream directly from our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.